I've just asked Mark not to introduce me. Mark asked me to come along and talk about culture and help seeking. It's quite clear from the way I speak that I was not raised in Australia. I speak a language many of you hear all of the time but don't realize what you're hearing. I speak immigrant. My speech is a hybrid of all sorts of influences that I've had in life, the different places I've lived. My vowel sounds are actually quite Australian. My consonants are Southern European, Mediterranean. My rhythm and cadence of speech is from the central part of North America. I speak hybrid. Wherever I go in the world, someone's going to say to me, "Where are you from?" Because it doesn't fit anywhere. And our beliefs are the same. As we get influenced by different places in life, by different things, our beliefs change according to where we might be. And in particular, we're going to talk about health beliefs, because as health professionals, particularly those of us in mental health, we know that our beliefs drive our behavior. Now, there is no single definition of the concept of culture, but there is no single definition of culture. Our best shortcut definition is the taken-for-granted world. It's the world that you think everybody shares when you first wake up in the morning. It's reality with a capital R until something else bumps into it. So that's our good shortcut definition. Now, quite clearly, as I mentioned, I was not raised in this country. I'm an immigrant. I've been here half of my life, and I still sound and look like this. I was the first person hired on the first deinstitutionalization crisis team in Australia. That was so long ago, it was before some of you were born. And the reason I mention that is I was on this team. We were based out in Ashfield initially, then Burwood. And I'd been in Australia a couple of months, and I'd go out and I meet people who say to me, "I'm from the bush." I hadn't a clue as to what that meant. But I soon learned that in Australia, that has a very, very specific meaning if you say, "I'm from the bush." We also know that within the last few generations, much of the Australian population has moved off of the land and now lives within 30 to 60 minutes drive of the coast. As Kurt mentioned this morning, we have the development of a surfy culture in some communities. And the reason I mention all of that is because we all have culture. We all have several cultures operating simultaneously. It is not something that happens to them. It's not about an other. And most of all, it's not about funny food and folk dancing. We all have multiple cultures operating simultaneously. We all share healthcare culture. We're all professionals in the healthcare industry. That's a culture with its own set of beliefs, rules, and operating systems. Culture is dynamic. It's constantly evolving. Now, remember what I mentioned about beliefs drive behavior? But to change a belief, you have to access that belief. Now, our beliefs around food are accessed several times a day. In my case, more often than that. And therefore, my behaviors change quite easily. You invite me to your house, I try something new. I invite you to my house, you try something new. Those things change easily. Our beliefs are accessed regularly, therefore they can change easily. Our behavior shifts readily. I do a lot of professional development in rural communities, and I still go to places where people will say things to me like, "I remember when the first Chinese restaurant opened. My parents didn't think that was real food." But our health beliefs are kind of a variation on that. Our health behavior is guided by our health beliefs, but our health beliefs are only accessed in times of sickness. And that is a lousy time to learn something new. And for that reason, beliefs about mental wellness, mental illness, and its treatment can go to the second and even to the third generation. Most of us can think in our own lives, or certainly in our family or amongst friends, that they have what we might call odd ideas about health. I'm not talking about the anti-vaccination people. I'm talking, that's a whole dangerous topic. But people who say, oh, well, you know, if you've got a pain, you have to put a red string around your ears. Or if you have a cold, you have to do this. If you have a fever, you have to do that. These are often traditional beliefs. And they can persist to the second and to the third generation. As I said, I'm not going to read these. I'll just put these up there to amuse you as we go along to give you some background of who we're talking about here in New South Wales. These are all immigrants. Earlier today, Kurt was talking to us about refugees. And Hamanta gave us her very inspiring story of coming here as a refugee. I need to point out that although the newspapers and some political parties would tell us that we're about to be swamped with refugees who are going to take our jobs and our homes and things like that, they represent 1% of the immigrants to this country. I'm here to talk about the other 99% as well, because they're a very, very small group, despite what the newspapers tell us. Now, the reason I put this map up there is because you will see that in some parts of New South Wales, particularly some areas of metropolitan Sydney, up to 40% of households have someone who prefers to communicate regularly in a language other than English as their everyday form of communication. What's important about that is that means that the household has, to one degree or another, people whose beliefs about mental wellness, mental illness, and its treatment are possibly more aligned with the beliefs of that language community than they are with the people who set up New South Wales Health. I'll repeat that because it's an important point. The beliefs of up to 40% of the population in some areas about mental wellness, mental illness, and its treatment are significantly different to the beliefs about the people in Miller Street in North Sydney who set up our mental health system. Now, we're talking about a significant mismatch of planning and a lot of squandered resources. So let's talk a little bit more about some of those differences, and as we become aware of them, maybe we can account for them. Now, research conducted by the Transcultural Mental Health Center, where I come from, we're a statewide organization, we're part of Ministry of Health, and we are here to back up the public health system, primarily the public mental health system. We serve all of New South Wales. The research we've conducted, particularly in rural areas, indicates that signs and symptoms of something wrong in one particular community are pretty universally recognized as signs and symptoms of something wrong in just about every community. The distinction, of course, is what we think is wrong, because that's going to guide where we're going to go to get help to do something about that. Anybody here ever wake up in the morning and think, oh, I don't feel so good. My head is just going in circles. It's a terrible day. I should stay under the covers. Oh, it must have been something I ate last night. Anybody ever wake up in the morning and think, I don't know what it is, but I'm so full of energy. Get out of the way, world. Here I come. I don't care if it's raining outside. I am full of sunshine. Look out! It must have been something I ate last night. In many communities, our moods are hardwired to our diet. What if it's a family issue? Maybe our moods and our circumstances are primarily the outcome of some family dynamic issue. I don't do family therapy, by the way. That's really hard work. Give me psychosis any day. Seriously, give me psychosis any day. It's I find that much less challenging than family therapy. But there is a complication if you think the family dynamics are part of the problem. What do you do if some of those family members that are displeased have been dead for a while? We have therapeutic interventions that account for ancestors, but we have to be open to the possibility that that has to be included. And now you're really talking about a multidisciplinary treatment plan. And I'm not saying that lightly, because we take these things into account. Tell me, has anyone here ever purchased a car? What are some of the key steps in buying a car? Sorry?
Saving.
Saving. Ah, prudence. Okay, what else? Okay, work, save, research. Then what? Sorry? Having a license. You're just so traditional. Test drive. Test drive the car. Okay, we test drive the car. What else? Make a decision. Maybe we decide on the make of the model. Yeah? Make a decision. Make, model, even color, what kind of features we want. We go to a dealer. The dealer offers us a price. And do we just write out a check and say, thank you very much, I'll pick it up tomorrow? What do? You what? All right, once you've got the best price, do you then just take it and go? Just, sorry? Once you get a best price from a dealer, do you just say, that's good enough for me, I'll take it? Sorry? Yep, you've done all that. You've got your best price. Do you just pay it? Okay. All right. Take a family member. Anybody go to another dealer?
Yes.
Yeah? Go to another dealer? Would you go to another dealer? Get it, see if you get a better price? You're incredibly disloyal. I don't know if I can sit next to you anymore. You're disloyal. When you've been so sick, have you ever been so unwell you went to your family doctor? You walk out maybe with a path slip or prescription? And you walk out the door, turn right, walk 3 blocks up the street to the strip mall, go into the GP bulk billing palace and see another GP. And after lunch, you see a third one just in case. And if you're not sure, tomorrow morning, will you see one or two more? Is that your normal health seeking? It's good enough for buying a car. You get another opinion when it's good enough for buying a car. Why isn't it good enough for your health? The people who run Medicare call that doctor shopping. In parts of the world, that's called smart. I'm going to find out what most people think is wrong with me. That's probably correct. I'm going to see the most common prescription. That's the medicine I'm taking. Medicare doesn't like that. But in parts of the world, that is absolutely orthodox help-seeking behavior. Once you get the medicine, and this is not a trick question, do you take it until the prescription is filled and the bottle is empty, or until the symptoms go? Do the symptoms go? What do other people do? Yeah, okay. NPR tells us, take it till the prescription's finished, right? But look, once the spirit that caused those symptoms has been driven out of your body, why do you need the special magical pills anymore? They're gone. The spirit is gone. The evil prankster spirits that have fun by making us sick, or the neighbors who are jealous of our success in the new world, in the new country, have cast a spell, but once we have driven that away, we don't need the treatment anymore. Isn't that accurate? We don't need to finish the bottles. If signs and symptoms of illness are caused by prankster spirits or evil spells, once the symptoms are gone, the spirit is driven away or the spell is broken, thank you very much, I'll be on my way. Some cultures have no concept of chronic disease because illness is caused by prankster spirits or evil spells or something similar to that. They're finite causes which can be fixed, even if you fixed it with chanting an amulet and a heavy dose of acuphase. But once the symptoms are gone, thank you very much, I'll be on my way. No concept of chronic disease, which is not just for psychosis, but cardiovascular disorders, hypertension, and other ongoing illnesses. So we have to be alert that these can be different help-seeking issues that will need to be taken into account when we're delivering health care, when we're trying to understand help-seeking. I used to work with a psychiatrist from Singapore, very cluey fellow. And some USSRI had just been released on the market. We were chatting, and he said, oh, if he assessed somebody and they had certain symptoms, he would give them this new antidepressant on the market. And of course, being a good conscientious practitioner, he would give them the usual speech. This is an antidepressant. You have to take it for 3 to 4 weeks before you get any antidepressant effect. Anything you find in the meantime is just a side effect, and then you have to take it for a couple of months before you see if this is the right one for you, etc., etc. We can all do that speech in our sleep, and you give the tear-off bits of paper from NPR or somebody from the pharmaceutical house that has all that same information written down on it. But if he had to assess them in Cantonese or Mandarin instead of English, he would give them the same medication, he would give them the same speech, you have to take this for 3 or 4 weeks before you get any antidepressant effect, anything else is a side effect, blah, 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 blah. Give them the information in traditional or simplified Chinese, and 50 milligrams of thioridazine to take at bedtime. Because if they didn't have a somatic punch to knock their boots a little bit, in a day or two they'd stop taking the medicine because it didn't work. They couldn't go back because he'd lose face as a bad psychiatrist, and they'd seem so ungrateful for his help. And this is an important point, that despite all the education, and we're talking about people here, some of whom were university students on exchange and things of that nature, these are highly educated, intelligent people, would not shift their basic understanding of how health care works. Think about, some of you who work in emergency departments, most of us have at one time or another in our careers worked in emergency. You get somebody who comes in and no one can make sense out of the symptoms. They just don't fit any pattern. And all of a sudden somebody, often it's the student, says, are you taking any medicines? And they pull out a shoebox. And they say, every morning I take 2 red ones and every night I take a blue one. If it's raining, I take the yellow ones. And my cousin says these green capsules are really helpful. With most of the world, most traditional medicines from around the world, you can do that safely. You cannot do that with pharmaceuticals. But they don't understand this. These are the kind of issues we come up with in cross-cultural healthcare. And I'm going to repeat what I said earlier. We're not just talking about people who come here and have a funny accent. We're talking about their children and sometimes their grandchildren, where health beliefs are passed down. So it's important to keep in mind that there may be a number of ways people are trying to access the health system. Another important issue is that the collaborative consumer-focused model may be absolutely baffling to people from other communities, other backgrounds. Aren't we all taught collaborative care? Especially in mental health, it's all about collaborative treatment planning, right? Recovery plans, things of that nature. Hey, what are you asking me what my opinion about this treatment for? If you don't know, geez, we're both stuffed. If you gotta ask me, you're supposed to know. You're paid to be here. What are you asking me for? People, particularly those from more hierarchical cultures, will just not get the collaborative model of care. It will baffle them and possibly frighten them off. The difference in expectations. Many people, particularly those who have come here from a very difficult background, will not understand what you can and cannot do. Many of them have never found a person in a position of authority working in their advantage. And by the way, I'm not just talking about people who have arrived in this country, I'm talking about people who might be the children and even the grandchildren of those who've come through some pretty difficult situations. We study the children, and now we're studying the grandchildren of people who came after the Second World War, and they still have, you don't waste food. You're careful, don't spend money on that. You can walk there, it's only a few, you know, it's only a couple of Ks, you don't have to take the bus. Many of us are familiar with this. This is not just obsessionality, this is a survival strategy. No one ever said to them, those rules, but they picked them up in their developmental years by seeing how their parents operated and the attitudes of people, the subtle influences as we were growing through our developmental years. And these are beliefs which move through generations. So we're not just talking about the person with the accent who came from somewhere else. We're talking about their children and sometimes their grandchildren. We're looking at 40% of New South Wales in some cases. 40% of your customers who will have different understandings. Are you working on my behalf, or do people in authority really care about people like me? By the way, I used to work in Southwest Sydney, and there are people who are multiple generations Australian for as far back as you can go, and that's also culture. And this is the culture of the disenfranchised. the culture of the people where no one in their gene pool has ever had their hand on a lever of power as far back as anyone can trace. And it's also a culture that we have to be aware of. Confidentiality is a bizarre concept, because what you and I call gossip, much of the world calls helpful information. How can I help if I don't know things? We have to talk about, fill in the blank, doesn't matter. Because how can we help if we don't know? And I'll tell you information so you can help. Our concept of confidentiality is based on the idea of the freestanding individual, the autonomous sentient biped up here. That comes from an accident of history in 13th and 14th century England. Up until that point, most of the world had pretty similar views of families, boundaries, confidentiality, individual identity. But because of an accident of history in the 13th and 14th century in England, things went in a different path to the entire rest of the world. And the English-speaking countries of the world, which share English common law tradition, are the only ones that follow that path. There's a few northwestern European countries that had some cross-fertilization of ideas with Britain, but for the majority of Europe and for the entire rest of the world, the family is the indivisible unit. It is not the freestanding biped up in the, all by himself up here. The family is the indivisible unit. That's my mom in your hospital. Yeah, look, I'm her carer. Why can't you tell me anything about her? Why can't we talk? That's my daughter you're looking after. Sure, she's 20 years old, but she's my daughter. She lives at home. I'd look after her. What's wrong? To the majority of the world, the family's the indivisible unit. Now, some of us have gone back and forth with the legal branch, or they used to be called the legal branch. I don't know what they're called today in health. And they actually get this. Eventually, they got it anyway. So they get this now, but as they say, we're not going to change 1,000 years of British common law tradition because of some immigrants. This is the way the system works in Australia. But so we have our privacy legislation on the state and Commonwealth level. We have our privacy codes. The Ministry of Health is now doing a big push to get everybody to sign these things along with our codes of conduct. But remember, please, that these ideas of confidentiality are quite confronting to a lot of our customers, because what you and I call gossip, they will regard as very helpful information. Now, I've made this quick so we can catch up some time, but we're going to have a panel later, and hopefully that'll work.